It's a weird feeling getting a life sentence. A lot of thoughts go through your mind. I let my family down. I let everybody down again. And then you lose your life. And you're never getting out. You think you're never getting out. And you just adapt to it.
My early childhood till I was 13 was actually really good. My dad was a baseball coach. We had a good life. We had pretty much everything a kid wanted. And then eventually, my dad started doing cocaine. I didn't know it at the time because I was young. But I quickly found out what was going on after my parents got divorced. There's a lot of drugs going through that house. And being a young kid, having ADHD and already being unstable adolescent as I was, I didn't know how to deal with any of that. Essentially what happened is I didn't grow up because I was just on drugs and just going crazy. And it took me down a really dark path. I started running around with different kinds of gangs and on the streets, selling meth, robbing cars, whatever I had to do to survive, essentially. Yeah. And I started getting shot at here and there. And it came to a point where you're going to have to start carrying a gun, too. One of the big things that is really bad for a person going through addiction is to have resentments. For anybody, for that matter. I don't care if you're doing drugs or not. Resenting people and being mad at people, it only hurts yourself. I was on a level 4 prisons pretty much my whole life. My first term, I was on level 3 for about 6 months, then went to level 4. Paroled, went right back to level 4. I don't like glamorizing prison. I just don't think it's good for kids to be hearing stuff like that. I've seen some crazy shit, dirtbag, scumbag shit that people do to their own people for nothing. And in the end, they all do the same stuff. But I'll say this, they started doing a lot of rehabilitation in prison. I started learning a lot about myself. I got a lot of education and I essentially changed my life. Prison saved me, but saved my life. And God, of course, giving my life to Jesus Christ saved my life. I'm still Chris Curtis. I still have the mentality. I still have these crazy thoughts. I have compassion. I care about people. I'm still me, but I have a heart now.
Chris Curtis, what's up, man?
How you doing today?
Good, dude. Thanks for driving down from Anaheim to San Diego. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
So you just got out of prison 2 years ago?
Yeah, about 2.5 years ago now.
And how much time did you do?
20 years.
Okay, that's crazy. 20 years and then 6 before that, right?
Yeah, correct.
Man, it's a lot of time.
Yeah.
And how old are you now?
Now I'm 52 years old.
Okay. And what'd you go to prison for?
This time or the first time?
Both.
Okay. The first time I went to prison for, I shot 2 people. It was aggravated assault with a firearm. I got lucky. I didn't get life for that.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of witnesses that said that they started it. And I got 6 years, but I got 2 strikes because of that case.
Right.
Because I shot 2 people, and that's great bodily injury. So they count each one of those as a strike.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, you know, what eventually happened after that was I did my 6 years. I got out, you know, with the intentions of doing good. And it didn't happen. I ended up relapsing, was selling drugs again. And about 8 months later, got surrounded by a bunch of police with a Glock 45, you know, a bunch of meth, and got in another high-speed chase, you know, and got arrested again. I was back in the county jail. I was looking at 107 years to life.
Damn.
You know? And so what happened was I ended up pleading guilty to the case because I was trying to get the Romero Act because that would have gave me 10 years. They would have, they call it striking a strike.
Right.
And I would have got 10 years. But with my, you know, previous history, it didn't happen. So what happened was, since I didn't take them all the way through the trial and waste all the money, they gave me 28 to life. So.
Got it.
That
okay.
That was in 2002.
Wow. Damn, 2002, man. A lot of big changes in the world.
Yeah, and at that time, you know, at that time, they were not letting nobody out. If you had a life sentence, that was it.
Yeah.
And I never thought that, you know, I'd get out of prison for years. I went through prison thinking, you know, that was it. And, by the grace of God, you know, they may change some laws. They started understanding that, you know, they started needed to let some people out. And they started letting lifers out through the Board of Prison Terms. They just didn't let me out. I had to go through the board, which is really difficult, you know, but I did it.
Yeah.
And here I am today, you know, successful. I'm an electrician.
Yeah.
Hey,
you turned your life around.
Yeah.
Congrats, man.
I have a great life, you know.
Yeah.
And I never thought I could have that.
Remember?
I never thought that I could have a life like this,
yeah.
You know, after everything I've been through. But I'm living proof that no matter what you've gone through, no matter what you're going through, you know, everybody has problems. Everybody's gone through something. And so have I.
Yeah.
And I made it through it. alive.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful for a second chance at life.
Yeah, and you're not letting that. A lot of people get chances and they let that shit go. They just go back to their old ways. They revert back to their programming and how they, you know. Let's talk a little bit about your programming, right? Like how you grew up. We talked a little bit earlier and on the Johnny Mitchell, the Connect Pod. You know, you mentioned that you didn't really have a chance, right? You were kind of, you had a really rough childhood. So let's talk a little bit about that.
All right. So my early childhood till I was 13 was actually really good. My dad was a baseball coach. We had a good life. You know, we had pretty much everything a kid wanted, you know. And then eventually my dad started doing cocaine. I didn't know it at the time because I was young, but I quickly found out, you know, what was going on after my parents got divorced. Me and my brother moved in with my dad, and the house was run down. They had people, you know, he had a roommate that lived there, you know. So, you know, one New Year's night, 83 or 84, somewhere around there, you know, me and my best friend were at the table listening to records. And my dad comes out with a little vial, you know, with this white substance in it. When I was a kid, you know, I'm thinking, you know, kind of knew what was going on, but not really. And he chopped three lines and did one and then offered it to me, and I did it. And then I gave it to my best friend, Jared, and he did it. And that was it. I was hooked.
Right.
And it was all over in that house. You know, people were coming and going all the time. We quickly figured out what was going on at the house.
Yeah.
There was a lot of drugs going through that house. And being a young kid, you know, having ADHD and already being unstable adolescent as I was.
Right.
You know, I didn't know how to deal with any of that. I didn't grow up. Essentially what happened is I didn't grow up because I was just on drugs and just going crazy.
Yeah.
And it took me down a dark path. It took me down a really dark path. And eventually I ended up with a life sentence in prison when it was all over. You know, we lived at my dad's for a couple years. Then the house got raided. And after that, I moved in with my mom for a little bit, then went back with my dad. And, you know, he couldn't get drugs because, you know, the connection was busted. But, you know, me and my friends, we would always go to Santa Ana to get cocaine or, you know, whatever, because we were now just using drugs all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would start go down there and get it for my dad. And there were times when, you know, I'm going out with my friends. And he's like, hey, I need you to give me some coke. I'm like, I can't, you know, I'm leaving. And then I'd be leaving, and then he would, like, yell down from the balcony, hey, you're on restriction, get back in the house, you know. And as a kid, I didn't really understand it, and,
right,
you know, like, what was going on.
Right.
But what happened was, like, I didn't take the trash out or something.
Yeah.
He was something. He would make it up. And then he'd come in and go, hey, can you give me some coke now? And of course. Yeah, of course, you know.
Yeah.
But later on in life, I realized after sitting in a cell for hours and hours and hours, you think about your life. You think about all sorts of stuff. If you've done a lot of time, you understand what I'm saying. Yeah. But, and he actually put me on restriction for not getting him coke. You know, I had a lot of resentments towards my dad for a long time. Later on, I started running the streets in Anaheim. This was after cocaine started doing meth.
Mm.
And that's when everything got really out of control.
And what year approximately?
That was like 89, okay. 89, 90.
And you know what, man? California, Southern California in like the late 80s, early 90s was popping, man. I mean, I was watching actually an episode of Cops the other day, and it was in 1989, and they were in, you know, South Central LA, and it was just murder, shooting, murder, like nothing, you know. And one of the cops was, they were looking for this guy, and then they got this call of a shooting, and the guy died, and he went and looked under the sheet, and he's like, well, it's one of my wanted suspects. Guess he's not wanted anymore, you know.
Yeah.
On to the next one, you know.
Yeah.
So was Anaheim, and you were in Anaheim?
Yeah.
Was it pretty popping in Anaheim?
Yeah, of course, you know. So the difference from back then to now, in my opinion, is that, you know, all the kids are on fentanyl now.
Yeah.
Which is very different from the meth back in the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was just spun out, just running around everywhere.
Yeah, being all wild, not sleeping.
And, yeah, now everybody's just, you know, sleeping. Essentially, they're just, you know, sleeping on the streets or, you know, it's like, it's just pharmaceutical heroin.
Yeah.
It's what it is.
Zombies.
Yeah. It's just different. And so I started running the streets. My mom ended up kicking me out of the house.
I just couldn't stop using drugs. I was a drug addict.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. And it just took over my life. And I started running around with different kinds of gangs and on the streets, selling meth, robbing cars, whatever I had to do to survive, essentially. Yeah. And I started getting shot at here and there. And it came to a point where you're going to have to start carrying a gun, too.
Yeah.
And I did.
Yeah.
And the last thing I ever thought that I would ever become like that. You know, I seen these other guys, you know, thinking I'll never be like that. But I ended up worse than them.
Yeah.
I was shooting at people for stupid reasons. And it was like nothing. And eventually I got caught. And I shot two people and went to prison.
So the first time you got shot at when you were young, how old were you?
I was probably 21.
Okay. And what happened? How did that feel? You know, getting shot at is...
It was pretty crazy. So we were still in Carstereo's in a Mexican neighborhood.
Oh, okay.
Where we weren't supposed to be at.
Yeah.
And what happened was this car drove by full of essays.
Yeah.
And they looked at my buddy and me and they're like, hey, you know, you can see him look out the window, like in the movies where you see the Mexicans drive by and they look out the window, you know, just like that. Yeah. I'll never forget it. And my buddy tells me, hey, once we turn around the corner, run. Do not let these guys catch you. They'll kill you.
Yeah.
And I thought he was kidding at first because I was just starting running the streets. This was like new for me.
Right.
And so we turn around the corner and he's gone. I'm like, fuck, I start running. But I like hid behind a dumpster. He jumped the fence and I hear the guys run by. They jumped the fence. They kept going. And I hear they're gone. So I kind of ran around the block a little bit, ran down the street. And I'm by the Anaheim police station now.
Yeah.
Walking down the street on Harbor. And these dudes drove by and shot at me.
Yeah.
They see me right over the police station and took a couple shots at me.
Right in front of the police
station. Right in front of the police station, yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
And did they come anywhere near you or?
I mean, I heard the bullets.
Yeah.
But, you know, they tried. Either they were trying or they were just trying to scare whatever. But it scared me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
After that incident right there, I started carrying a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And.
So where'd you get your first gun?
God, I can't even remember. I think, one of my buddies, I was selling drugs with one of my buddies and he used to come across guns all the time and he just gave me one. I can't remember which one it was so long ago.
Yeah.
But I went through several guns after that.
Yeah.
You know, Tech Nines, whatever I can get my hands on, you know? So, yeah, I've had tons of guns.
So when you were going to school, like when did you finish high school? Or
no, I dropped out in like seventh grade.
Yeah, because you were just spun out doing drugs.
Yeah, I just had no guidance.
Yeah. You had mentioned that you resented your father for a long time. Did you ever get to a point where you were kind of at peace with what happened and forgave him?
In around 2015, I started taking a lot of groups in prison. They started offering several self-help courses.
Yeah.
And I started learning a lot about addiction, you know, victim's impact. I learned all sorts of stuff, you know, about myself. And one of the big things that is really bad for a person going through addiction is to have resentments.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody, for that matter. I don't care if you're doing drugs or not.
Yeah.
Resenting people and being mad at people, it only hurts yourself.
Yeah.
And what I realized is that, you know, my dad was obviously sick too. He had a drug problem, whatever went down. His dad was an alcoholic. He had problems too. And, you know, I forgave him. You know, I still, you know, I'm still mad at times.
Yeah.
But essentially it made me who I am today, what I went through, which is a good person. It took me a long time to get here.
Right.
But another thing I learned too is that you just can't blame all your problems on other people. For me, if you just blame all your problems on other people, without taking responsibility for your actions, you're always going to, you know, fall behind.
Yeah. Like, when was it when you kind of had that realization? Was it once you'd been locked up for a while and had some time to kind of
about 15,
ponder?
15 years into my second term.
Wow. Damn. So
like I was using
80% of it.
Well, I was using drugs and just running around in prison for 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, I was on methadone because they were giving it out in prison.
Yeah.
You know, for pain. Back at the opioid epidemic was in prison too.
Yeah.
You have knee pain, they put you on, you know, morphine or
money,
methadone.
Man. It's money. Somebody's making money on it.
And I got strung out on that stuff. But I always just blamed, I'll never be anything because my dad started me on drugs. I'm a drug addict. I'll never be anything. I can't go to school. I got ADHD. I can't learn. I can't do this. I can't do that. And essentially, once I started taking responsibility for my life, I got an AA degree, electrical vocation. I wrote a book, you know. And everything I said I couldn't do, I've done.
Yeah.
And now look at me. I have a great life right now. I'm an electrician. You know, I'm very grateful to have a second chance at life. But all those things I said I could not do, I've done. And I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep moving forward.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's very important that people, you know, understand that it doesn't matter where you've been or where you've come from. If you want to do something, you just got to do it.
Yeah. How much undoing did you have to try and do in prison with your childhood? Like, because look, we are set up as adults by our childhood, right? Like the first 7 years are really the most important. But again, like really up until like, I don't know, I didn't feel like I was a man until I was like 25, 26, you know what I mean? So like there's a lot of pivotal moments that shape your future and it's really hard to undo that. But it seems like you really did, right? Like we have this subconscious programming by the experiences that we have when we're younger, right? You see your mom get hit by your dad, and that goes into your head, right? In one way or another. Maybe you just don't trust men, or maybe you go off and do the same thing or whatever, right? I mean, you're 13 years old, your dad's giving you coke, and then, I mean, you're off and running, right?
Yeah.
So what did you do to kind of reprogram yourself? Because obviously you did.
I think prison reprogramming.
Really?
Being structured. You know, every day doing the same thing, getting up every day, working out. That was a big thing for me.
Yeah.
You know, I've always worked out in prison. I still work out today.
Yeah.
So for me, I have to go to the gym at least 5 days a week. I go to the gym. I think that essentially what it comes down to is changing your life. It's like growing up all over again. Mm. Because when you're on drugs, you're not growing up. You're just stuck in that pattern. You're not maturing. So I was doing drugs at 13 years old. And then before that, I was on Ritalin as a kid in kindergarten. I was on Ritalin, you know, because I was hyperactive.
Yeah.
So I was not growing up at all. I was immature. I wasn't taking responsibility for my life. And I just kept ruining it. And I kept blaming all my problems on everybody but myself. So going to prison and getting away from drugs, you know, I started growing up.
Right.
I started seeing... You know, I've seen a lot of violence in prison.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're younger, it's different. It's like, oh, this is cool. This is great, you know, or whatever. But once you start getting older and you get a conscience and you start learning about victims' impact and you start learning about yourself, you know, and the victims that you're creating along the way.
Yeah.
If you got a conscience, you're going to start thinking, okay, hey, wait a minute. And you start growing up. That's for me, though. Everybody's different. You know, when I speak my story is my story. It's what worked for me.
Yeah.
But everybody's different.
Right.
You know, I could just speak for myself and a few other people that I know that would agree with me because I have a lot of friends that are lifers that are out right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing great.
Yeah.
They're doing great. And that's because they went through all these programs in prison.
Would you say that the rehabilitation in prison works?
It does to an extent. So if you're a lifer... In order for you to get out of prison, you have to go through the Board of Prison Terms. So what they're asking for is for you to give them a parole packet before you go to board. You have an insight paper. You have relapse prevention plans. You know, why you joined a gang, how you're going to stay away from a gang. You know, you got to do all this stuff, and you got to present it to the board, and then you got to go speak about it. And to do that, you have to learn about it. So... Any lifer that's listening to this right now will agree with what I have to say. When you first start doing these groups in prison because you're going to the board, almost everybody goes in saying, oh, I'm just doing this for the board. I'm just doing this for the board. I'm just doing this for the board. And eventually they start speaking, they start learning, and it's, you know, you don't get a lot out of each group.
Right.
But you do take something out of each group that helps you move forward. And then
plants a seed, right?
Yeah. And then the next thing you know... You're starting to learn about yourself and you're starting to change. And it does work. But there's a lot of people in prison that don't have life sentences.
Yeah.
So they're just going to prison and they're just waiting for their day to get out. They don't have to do nothing to get out.
Right.
You know? And 95% of them reoffend.
Yeah.
It's a big number.
Yeah, it's sad. It's sad because, like you said, like when you're talking about victims' impact and things like that, we don't realize that. You know, I was talking to one of my good friends about this little girl that went up to her car, right? Little 5-year-old girl saw her car. She's got a cool little Miata. And this girl was just like, oh, wow, I love this. And she had her sit in the car, right? And it just made the girl's day. And like to us as adults, that looks like a really small thing, right? Like we'll forget that by the end of the day. But that kid will never forget that. And that little moment will create patterns throughout their life from that, right? So yeah. So when you shoot at somebody and it causes them to get a gun and then they go out and they shoot somebody, like there's such a negative impact that can come from that. But vice versa, on the positive side, by you sharing your story and somebody hearing it that needs to hear it, it has that same positive impact. So the cool thing is, like, instead of going down that negative road and just spiraling and just saying, fuck it, you turned your life around even when you thought that there was no getting out, right? Yeah. Which maybe that pushed you to that point. But you know, I think giving people who have similar stories a perspective that they can change, because most people don't think it's even possible, so they don't even begin. But when you give somebody hope, hope is such a powerful tool. It's such a powerful thing because, you know, it'll drive you through some of the darkest places because you get that little light at the end of the tunnel. And trust me, man, I've been in some dark spots and I've turned my life around a lot, you know. And I can understand what you're saying about being on Ritalin at a young age. I mean, I was, when I was like 9 years old, put on Ritalin, Zoloft, all sorts of stuff. Because I was just a little hyperactive as a kid. Like I was a fucking kid.
Yeah.
And they put me on drugs. And my parents, you know, they are just trusting the doctors. They think the doctors know what they're saying.
It's big pharma.
And it's the money, bro.
It's big pharma.
And dude, that fucked me up. Like it really, like it took me a while to develop into like a fully functioning adult in that period of like 18 to 21. I mean, nothing crazy, but I just didn't. Because like you were saying, like, sure, I wasn't smoking meth. I wasn't on like drugs, but it might as well be the same thing. It's messing with your brain chemistry and it's changing things at fire and wire. And I understand that, man. And it sucks because it, again, like that puts you in a different direction. And, you know, I think there's a time and place for medicines like that, but, you know, it should be a temporary thing. I don't think it should be a forever thing. You know, my sister was on Adderall for a long time and Ritalin, all sorts of stuff. And you know, she killed herself. She shot herself.
Oh, gosh.
And I really believe that that was a main reason why. And, you know, that's a big problem that not a lot of people talk about, you know.
And that's mental health. That's another big thing in the world is mental health. And they're treating it. They just treat everything with drugs.
Right.
And it makes it worse. You know, if you notice a lot of the drugs that they offer now, you know, me and my fiance were talking about it. Almost everything that you take says it could, you know, give you suicidal thoughts if it does stop.
Yeah, right.
It's crazy if you think about it.
Yeah.
And they're just pumping these drugs out all over the place.
Yep. Yep. It's, I never really like taking, you know, even, I don't even take ibuprofen, right? Like, unless I really, really have to. You know, and I think it's probably because of, you know, my childhood being, and you know, what's crazy is the day that my dad finally was like, fuck this, we're taking you off these drugs. We're calling the doctor. And because it was causing way more problems than it was solutions.
Yeah.
And I think I was like 13 years old, just about to go into high school. And the drugs, these pills had like stunted my growth. So going in my freshman year of high school or my eighth grade, right before high school, I was one of the shortest kids in the school and I was one of the oldest.
Me too.
There were sixth graders that were much taller than me. But the day that it was literally like the just after my dad was like, nope, we're done. You're not doing this anymore. We're pulling you. My behavioral patterns started to shift into a positive way. I started doing better at school. I started doing better at literally every aspect of life. I turned into like this little pudgy kid, short, kind of fat kid, not fat, but like just, you know, it changes your weight, you know? And all of a sudden I turned into, I grew like crazy. I mean, I was tiny. I was barely 100 pounds.
I was like 4'11 until I turned like 17 or 18 years old. It was crazy.
Way.
Yeah, I was the smallest kid and skinny from being on Ritalin.
And how tall are you now?
Five, almost 6 feet.
Yeah, you're like 5'11". Yeah.
Yeah, I see friends that I didn't see for like, because I moved out of the city of Orange.
Yeah.
You know, like 15 or 16.
Yeah.
And then I see them years later.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the hell, you know?
It's funny you say that because I lived in Alaska for a little while and we moved from Alaska. And when I was 14, end of my freshman year of high school. And then I went back when I was 17 and I was like a normal, I was always the small kid, right? People were always, you know, like, I was a tiny kid. And when I went back, people were like, holy shit, what the hell? Why are you so, like that? People didn't recognize me. My teachers didn't recognize me. It was awesome. But lucky not to be one of those stunted kids. Did you get off Ritalin how old were you when you were?
Well, there's something happened. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember my mom, or I remember some study came out. I can't remember exactly, but they were saying that, you know, Ritalin is terrible for kids.
Yeah.
You know, you got to take them off of it. This was after me being on it for, you know, 6-7 years or whatever.
Yeah.
And they took me off of it.
Yeah.
But then I was on cocaine right after that.
So. Yeah, well, maybe cocaine's better than Ritalin. Who knows, man?
And then I was on meth again, which is Ritalin pretty much anyway. So.
Yeah. That's crazy. So let's go back. So let's talk about the first shooting. What led up to that and just break that down?
There was a few events that led up to that moment. So me and my buddy, we were selling a lot of drugs at this time. And I remember we were at this one house, and this guy wanted to buy an ounce of meth. So he pulls up to the house, but he don't want to come in. The girl tells me, hey, this guy wants to buy an ounce of meth out here. I'm like, all right. Tell him to come in. He's like, no, he don't want to. I'm like, all right. So I grab an ounce of meth. I got my gun on me. I go out there. It's right by Disneyland. I tell him, hey, give me the money. He's like, no, give me the dope first. And I showed him my gun. I'm like, dude, if I wanted your money, I'd just take it.
Yeah.
So he throws the money on the seat, and it looks like the money's there. I mean, there's a big wad of cash. So I pick up the money, throw them, you know, ounce of dope on the seat, and he just burns rubber. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, what's going on here? Is the money fake? What's going on? So I start shooting at him. So I'm shooting at this dude as he's going around the corner right there by Disneyland.
Yeah.
And, I go back in the house.
Broad daylight? Oh, no way.
Yeah, my buddy's, you know, what now? You know, because I'm always doing stuff like this. And he's like, what now? I go, dude, I don't know. Count the money or whatever. Is it real? And it was $5 short.
Right.
You know? So this dude.
Was he paranoid about that? Or was he tripping because you were paranoid and he could
tell? I don't know what happened, but all I know is this dude's burning rubber. I don't know if the money's fake or what's going on. Because at that time, everybody's making money. You can't really tell the difference.
If somebody's buying an ounce of meth, are they reselling it then?
Well, yeah, they do.
I mean, it's not like an ounce of weed.
Or they're using it or, themselves. You know, whatever they got going on. But
how much did an ounce of meth cost?
Back then, it was like $650, I think.
$650?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you got $6.45 or whatever. And
he just counted the money and he goes $5 short. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, but my thing in my mind is, why is this guy doing that?
Yeah.
He could have just took off.
Yeah.
And, he already had the dope. I mean,
right.
But in my mind, I was like, what is this guy doing? And that's how high strung and how, you know, off the chain I was at this time.
Yeah.
So this guy is, now all these friends are like, hey, you're shooting at our friend or, you know, and I'm like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So then later on down the road, one of their friends gets killed in a high-speed chase. And me and my buddy that were, you know, in that house were on the phone. He was in Chuckawalla prison at the time. We were, you know, he called and I was talking to him on the phone. I was on the streets. And there's this girl there and we're talking about the high-speed chase. That dude got killed. And we laughed about it. He wasn't our friend, you know.
Yeah,
we just laughed
about
it, you know, because we were just heartless scumbags, you know.
Yeah.
And she went and told her friends. So they're calling all my friends saying, hey, we're going to get Chris, you know, because of the shooting and because of, you know, clowning their dead friend. And so, So now these guys are like saying they're going to get me. About a month or two later, I run into them. I didn't know it was them at first. I was out, you know, I was in a car. This girl went up to drop something off. I see a bunch of dudes hanging out front. I'm just sitting there. I got my gun on me. So I'm not, you know. Yeah. I'm not tripping on them. So they leave and I go up in the apartment and they come in the apartment. And then they're looking at me. Now I realize who these guys are. It's all these guys that are saying they're gonna try to get me.
Yeah. When you say trying to get you, they're trying to kill you or
whatever.
Yeah.
Kill me, beat
Jump
me up.
You. Yeah.
Whatever. They leave and I tell the girl, hey, we're out of here. You know, and there's an older guy there, he's all tatted up, and he's like, hey, these guys are gonna be waiting for you out there. I'm like, I don't care. I'm leaving.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're going to get guns. Whatever the case may be, I'm at, my best chance for me is to get out.
And you're in a dope house or where?
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Some kind of house.
Yeah.
You know, there's kids there and stuff like that. I don't want nothing. You know, I don't want nothing to go down there, but
I'm leaving. Yeah.
You know, I'm not getting. So I'm walking down the stairs. You know, they're all at the bottom of the stairs. I tell her to get in the car. I'm like, they're not going to mess with you. So I get to the bottom of the stairs. I got my hand in my pocket. And I'm like, what's up? And they just ignore me. They're just like looking at me. And I'm like thinking to myself, you know, whatever. These guys ain't going to do nothing.
Right.
So I walk and I get in the passenger seat of the car. So now they rush the car and they're hitting me through the window, trying to hit me. And I'm like, you know, just got my hand up, like blocking it. And they start opening the door. So I just shot them.
Yeah.
And we took off, you know.
And you shot both of them, right?
Well, there was like seven dudes.
Oh, shit.
I just shot. I just counted five times. I had my little 22.
Yeah.
I just counted. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, and that was it.
Right.
And they're gone. You know, one guy was crawling away when I got out of the car because she stalled the car. She thought
they were shooting. Oh, so you were in the passenger
seat. Yeah, she thought they were shooting at us. She stalled the car.
Yeah.
So I get out to drive.
Right.
And
right.
I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And we went and painted her car. And then I was, you know, the police paged me. Like 5 minutes.
They hit you on your pager?
The police paged me like
five. Did you call them?
I did.
Really?
Well, I called the number. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
I'm like, hello? They're like, hey, this Chris? Yeah. Chris Curtis? I'm like, yeah. This is the Iron Police Department. You know, don't you think you should come turn yourself in? I'm like, for what? They're like, you know for what?
Yeah.
I'm like, are you going to arrest me if I go down there? They're like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, all right. I'll be down there. You know, I just.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. And they
it
know.
It was on. Yeah.
So
and then my friend, and then another buddy of mine, he called, he paged me, and I called him back. This is like a little bit later, not long after that. He goes, hey, I heard your name over the scanner. You're wanted for 2 counts of attempted murder.
So you didn't kill these guys, right?
No.
They did you think when you guys drove off, were you, was it in your head, like, did you even think, like, hey, did I kill those guys, or were you not even?
I didn't even.
Yeah.
You know, they attempted murder. They weren't dead yet.
It's still. I mean, right after the shooting, right? Like you shoot these two dudes, and you know, you guys drive off.
At that time, I just
you didn't even care, huh?
It was one of them things, you know, where it was either me or them. The way I looked at it.
Yeah, I mean, to me,
you know, they're trying to get me. I'm going to get out of there.
Yeah,
I'm going to win either way.
Well, I mean, to me, if what you're saying is true, then it sounds like self-defense, right? Like these guys, I mean, if there's seven of them, right?
Yeah.
They can beat you to death if you can prove in a court of law that you feared for your life, you know. So what?
Yeah, but once you take off from the scene, and if you have a stolen gun, it changes all that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, once I did get arrested, I got in a high-speed chase, you know, crashed, and the detective was walking me to the car because there was undercover cars that, you know, surrounded me and they ended up catching me.
Yeah.
He told me, hey, you should just turn yourself in. These guys said they started everything. And I'm thinking to myself, like, turn myself in? You know, I'm thinking in my mind, I'm getting a life sentence.
Right.
And then I didn't understand it until I got to court.
Had you already had a strike or no?
No, I've never been to prison at this time. I've been to county jail like 10 times.
Yeah.
But nothing like this.
Right.
And
were you a felon?
Not yet.
Okay.
Maybe, no, I was a felon, but nothing crazy.
So what made you think you were getting life for two attempted murder charges?
Well, back then, attempted murder is 25 to life.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Attempted murder is 25 to life.
Got it.
Especially back then.
Yeah.
So once they said, you know, 2 counts attempted murder, I'm done.
Right.
It's a life sentence. And back then, a life sentence is, you know, 25 to life. If they tell you you got 25 to life, it means you got life.
Yeah.
Because you're going to board, they're not letting you out.
Right.
It's like life without at that time.
Yeah.
They didn't let people out for years who had life. Once you had 25 to life, 7 to life, you know, 10 to life, whatever it is, you're not getting out.
Yep.
And so I just, you know, I thought it was done. And then when I got to court, my first time at court, you know, the public defender goes, hey, they're offering you 6 years, 85%. You want to take it? I'm like, yeah. And then I understood, you know, especially after reading the police report.
Yeah.
There was witnesses. These guys said I started it. They started it. And that was it.
Yeah.
But the problem with that was I got two strikes.
Right.
So no matter what I do, you know.
Well, then you go to prison. And then if you get caught with a knife in prison, is it a
anything.
Felony?
Yeah. It was a little bit of meth.
But is that considered a strike?
Yeah.
Oh, so.
Back then.
So you know you're going to strike out if you go in, right?
Well, that's what you think? I didn't. But yeah, there was a very, I never thought I was going to get out. I'll tell you that.
Right.
I got very lucky.
Yeah.
But I ended up getting out, striking out anyways.
In prison?
No, when I got out. I got out in 2002. I got out.
Right.
With two strikes.
How long did it take you to go back to prison?
8 months.
Damn.
And then I got 28 to life.
Yeah. Well, how did you feel when you got out of prison the first time, right? You shot these two dudes and then you get out of prison, yeah. Right?
I never thought I was going to come back. I was really determined not to use again.
Yeah.
Not to come back. But it was different back then. They didn't send you through all these courses and make you do all this stuff. Like I said, you're just waiting to get out.
Yeah.
You know, plus they didn't have all the groups like they do now. I didn't learn nothing about myself. I mean, I got my GED, but that's, I didn't learn anything about myself. I was still blaming all my problems on everybody else. I wasn't taking responsibility for my life. I stayed clean for a couple months. And then I went around, you know, they got this thing called people, places, and things. Have you ever heard that saying?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, your surroundings.
Your surroundings, yeah.
Yeah.
And I started hanging out with my old friends that were still using, thinking that I wouldn't. And I didn't for a while. I started selling drugs. I wasn't using them, but I was selling them.
Sure.
And that went on for like two months. And then I started using it, and that was it.
Right.
I got picked up a gun, and then it was over.
Yeah.
And, you know, 8 months later, I was surrounded by the cops.
Yeah. So what happened? What led you to go into prison again?
I was just selling a lot of drugs. I gave them a dirty test. And, you know, at that time, you give a dirty test or whatever, it's a year in prison.
Right.
You know, it's different now, of course, but.
Yeah.
And I just, that's it. I'm not going, you know, you're going to have to catch me. That's just my mentality.
Right,
you know,
right.
Come and get me.
Yeah.
And that was a bad mentality to have, but, you know, it essentially got me a life sentence.
Yeah. So you're, from what I remember, you're in a garage somewhere working on your motorcycle, and you kind of knew the cops were coming
for you?
Yeah, that
was after the shooting, a couple months after the shooting.
That was the first time?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So what? How did you end up getting surrounded by the cops the second time?
So I was selling a lot of drugs. I would only stay in Anaheim, like in Orange County, for like 24 hours, and then I'd take off out of state. I'd
Got
go
it.
To Arizona, drop off meth, and then I'd take off to Idaho.
Were you on a motorcycle or a car?
No, I was in rental cars. I used rental cars.
Okay.
I had a motorcycle at the time, but I would take rental cars.
Yeah.
And I would change them every week. I'd rent them in other people's names, so it wasn't in my name because cops were after me.
Yeah.
I had a PAL warrant, probably at large. So, but I was running a lot of drugs around.
Oh, so you were already on the run?
Yeah. Like 3 months after I got out, I was on the run.
And you were on the run because you were selling drugs?
Because I gave them a dirty test.
Got it. So you...
Yeah.
Gave them a dirty test and they didn't pop you right away.
They test you and then you leave.
Oh, that's right. Okay. It wasn't like the instant.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
They test you and you leave. And then, you know, I knew I gave them a dirty test.
Yeah. So then you're on it. Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay,
and then
it.
Me
okay.
being on high control, parole, gang patrol, and all that other stuff, it's over.
Yeah. Yep.
For anybody back then, you get a dirty test, it's over.
Yep.
Very rarely are you're getting a year violation. That was the big thing back in the 90s.
So you thought you were only going back for a year?
I knew that I was going to get trouble. I should have turned myself in,
yeah,
but I didn't.
Right.
Because because essentially what's going to happen is I'm going to get life. Because you get busted with anything at this time, you're done.
Right.
A little bit of meth, you're done.
Right.
And, you know, me, you know, having that mentality where, you know, I don't care.
Yeah.
Whatever, let's do this.
Right.
You know, and I was. And I was running around with a gun in my pants every day. Wouldn't go nowhere without it.
Right.
And I was selling a lot of drugs. But I would only stay in California, you know, in Orange County for 24 hours and I'd leave because I know that they would find me.
Right.
And I stayed too long one time. I stayed overnight and the next day because I had some stuff to do. And sure enough, I was leaving a hotel room and I was driving down Cotella and Harbor, going towards Angel Stadium. And there was a cop car at the light right here. And it was like, you know, go around. And I thought he was just saying, hey, don't go this way. Go this way. I thought something was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I pulled into the gas station, then just a bunch of unmarked cars just surrounded me.
Right.
And I got the Glock 45 on my lap. I got a bunch of meth.
And did you try to run or no?
Yeah, I got two strikes.
Right, right.
And again, here we are, like, okay, catch me if you can.
Yeah.
They left a little opening. I was gone.
So what happened when
another
you
another high-speed chase.
In a car?
In a car, yeah.
Okay.
And I was careful not to hit nobody.
Yeah.
Because I know that that would be a violent strike. You know, in the back of my mind, I knew I was done.
Yeah.
And I, you know, ditched the car, jumped some fences, you know, was pouring meth in pools, just trying to get rid of everything, to evidence.
And damn.
And I had a clock.
Some kids swimming in there like, wow, I feel so energized.
Yeah, it's not right. You're not thinking about that, you know?
Yeah.
And so I had the Glock 45 still on me, and I knew I had to get rid of it, you know? So I jump on a fence, and the helicopter, and now there's, you know, it's nighttime, and the helicopter's lights on me, and then it goes off me. I balanced it on a tree branch.
And what, this is 2002?
Yeah. October 2002.
So are they, I mean, are they tracking you with infrared then?
Do you know what? I don't, well, they, oh, yeah, but they had the light on. So the thing is that they had the light on me.
Yeah.
So I know that if they have the light on me, they could see me do more with the cameras or whatever they got.
Yeah, because they'll switch from white, from like a light, and then they'll,
well, that's
go to
different
infrared.
Back then. And two, this is different back then. So they had the light on. Back then, they would have the light on you.
Yeah.
But once they took it off of me, I balanced the gun on a tree branch.
Yeah.
Jumped off the wall, jumped over another fence, and they were already there.
Yeah.
There was
six
cops. Get down. It was over.
Yeah.
And, you know, went to jail.
Yeah.
And then the next day, the sheriffs call me out, you know, to go talk to the police. They want to talk to me, the sheriffs, because the Orange County sheriffs were the ones that came looking for me.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, we found your gun. You know, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
I'm done. I told them I'm through. I told them, like, I'm through. I'm out of here. I don't even want to talk to you guys.
Yeah.
And then I read the police report and it said that, you know, the girl that lived at the house was picking lemons out of a tree and the gun fell out of the tree and landed in the bucket. You know, that's what they say anyways.
Yeah.
But, that was in the police report.
That's crazy. Yeah. So you go to prison, and what's your mindset when you first go to prison? Like, what are you thinking? You've already been to prison. You're coming back, and now you feel like you're not leaving. So are you just, like, ready to fuck shit up or
what? You know, it's a weird feeling getting a life sentence. You know, you go through a lot of thoughts go through your mind. You know, I let my family down. I let everybody down again. And then you lose your life, you know? And you're never getting out. You think you're never getting out. And you just adapt to it. You know, I was on a level 4 prisons pretty much my whole life. My first term, I was on level 3 for about 6 months, then went to level 4 and spent the rest, that whole time on level 4. Paroled, went right back to level 4.
Yep.
And you just go through the days, dude. You know, you work out. You just watch yourself. You know, you be, you know, careful in what you do. You watch people, and you just learn. Once you have a life sentence, that's it. You know, it's over. And I really wasn't too crazy in prison, but I know a lot of people that were.
Yeah.
You know, I did a lot of stuff in prison, but I know a lot of people done a lot worse.
Right.
I wasn't really all that in prison. Like, people will get on these podcasts, and they'll say, you know, I was this, I was that. You know, whatever. I don't like glamorizing prison.
Right. That's,
you know,
good.
I don't like glamorizing it.
It's,
I don't,
not
think
a,
it's,
place
I don't,
you want
to
be.
I just don't think it's good for kids to be hearing stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you this. I'll say that, you know, everybody's got their own way they deal with prison. I've been through a lot of shit in prison. I've seen a lot of crazy things, you know, and some of the stuff I can't get it out of my mind. You know, I've seen some crazy, crazy shit, some dirtbag, scumbag shit that people do. To their own people.
Yeah.
For nothing. You know, and in the end, they all do the same stuff, you know. But I'll say this. You know, when they started doing a lot of real rehabilitation in prison, I started learning a lot about myself. I got a lot of education. And I essentially changed my life. Prison saved me. You know, it saved my life. And God, of course.
Yeah.
You know, giving my life to Jesus Christ saved my life.
So this is one thing that I want to touch on. So did you believe in God when you were growing up? Or did you grow up religious? Or did you have a
relationship
with God? I believed
in God, not like I do now.
Yeah. When you went to prison the first time, did that change your relationship
with
God?
Well, I'll tell you what really changed it. This is kind of a crazy story. So this is back in the 90s, maybe the early 2000s before I got out my first term. I remember coming out to work. I worked in the main kitchen. At this time, I worked in the satellite kitchen, which was on the yard. So I'd get up really early in the morning and come out. And I remember the CO telling me, hey, you don't see that shadow walking back and forth from your cell? I'm like, no. You know, I didn't think nothing of it. And I went to work. And a couple months later, you know, I had a cellie that was a Christian. And he wasn't crazy. It'd be like me and you talking here. He's not crazy. He's not, you know, on meds or, you know, not a J-cat.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wake up one morning and he's like in the corner of the cell, like by the door, like, why there's a ghost. And I'm like, what are you tripping on? Like, what's going on? He's like, when I woke up this morning, I seen a demon sitting on you. I'm like, what the? And at first I'm like, yeah, you're crazy. Like, whatever. But I started thinking about that.
Yeah.
And it started bugging me. And I started reading the Bible then. But that started getting me to read the Bible.
So the guard saw a shadow going back and
forth?
Yeah. I got a fucking crazy story for you.
Well, that's because a lot of people think, oh, yeah, you're crazy or whatever. But anybody who's been, there's some crazy things happen in there.
So in 2019, I'm on a Zoom call with my business partner and friend.
Yeah.
In this building. And I'm like, hey, I got to go to, and this kid and I, we've been friends since we were 8 years old.
Yeah.
So we've known each other since we were little kids. And we're on a Zoom call and we had been like building a business together and whatever. And I'm like, hey, I'll be right back. I got to go take a piss. So I walk out. When I come back, he's like, hey, bro, there's a shadow going back and forth in your office. Like, are you fucking with me? And I'm like, come on. And now I'm thinking I'm, you know, because him and I are pranksters, whatever. I'm like,
yeah,
we've been doing this since we were little kids. Like, you're fucking with me, right? And I thought he was fucking with me the whole time, right? Never did I ever really think anything of it. I'm just like, guys, just messing with me. Even though there's some weird stuff that has happened in this building.
Oh, this building, I guarantee you this building is haunted.
Yeah.
I guarantee. We were talking about that walking in. Like, some of these buildings are haunted.
Yeah, it's just an old building. But so he's saying that the shadow's going back and forth, and I'm like, whatever, I disregard it. That night, when I'm laying in bed and just about to fall asleep, maybe like 11, midnight, going to sleep, and I get this feeling, this presence of this. And this used to happen when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
I got this presence of this darkness. Like, I cannot, it's like in Harry Potter, they have these things that fly around and they suck the soul out of people.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like. Just like this, like a magnet pulling you. And it just, the worst feeling ever. And I remember just like hearing my mother telling me a story about her had a situation like this when she was younger and she yelled, go away. And I literally out loud yelled, go away. And whoo, it felt like it was gone.
Yeah.
And I was like, that was
it's
weird.
Real, bro.
Well, dude,
it's
that,
real.
That night was the night that my sister committed suicide right around that time.
That's crazy, dude. That gives me the chills. I got crazy. I'll never forget that. I can imagine what you're going through with your sister like that. That's terrible. I'm sorry to hear that.
I didn't believe in this stuff then.
Yeah.
You know, like it took me after I got sober to start believing in God or a God and then kind of like, you knock and the door opens, right?
Well, but I've always believed in it because when I was a kid, this is before my parents got divorced, you know, when we still had a normal childhood. I remember we were going snow skiing and my dad tells me, hey, go get your snow skis because we're going to wax them. And so I take off running down the hall. At the end of the hall, I'm like, I see a figure like there. You know, the only way I can explain it is like if your body falls asleep, it's tingling. That's, you know, tingling, if you could see that in there. And it was a girl.
Right.
I took off, told my dad, he goes, yeah, you're crazy. And then a couple nights later, or like, I don't remember how much later, I was sitting, I was trying to sleep and I couldn't sleep. I was just a kid. And so I went in my parents' room and went to sleep. And then I'm laying in their bed. And at the end of the bed, it was just staring there looking at me.
Yeah.
That girl presence just tingling. Mm. So I've seen, you know, I've seen it. I know, you know, I can't explain it.
Yeah.
And when my buddy told me this, you know, he's not a J-cat. You know, anybody at prison knows, when I'm saying J-cat, you know what that means, right?
No.
So a J-cat is essentially a person that's crazy.
Okay.
You know, they're on meds. They're not all there.
Yeah.
Don't trust them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Stay at arm's distance.
Got it.
You know, they can't be trusted.
Got it.
You know, you got different levels of J-cats.
So he's a solid dude that you, and you can read people well, right?
He's just a good dude. He's smart. And he's just, you know, he's a Christian.
Yeah.
But it would be like talking to somebody that's very coherent.
Yeah.
You know, hey, he's like, dude, like there was a demon sitting on you when I woke up this morning.
Yeah. And you got one tattooed on you.
Yeah, I got all sorts of crazy ass tattoos.
Do you get all that in prison?
Yeah. My whole body's covered.
Yeah. So what year did you give your life to Jesus Christ?
Around that time. Yeah. But so, you know, and then I remember when I was on the run for the shooting, you know, my daughter was being born. So I went to the hospital. I'm on the run. I got a gun in my pants. I go to the hospital. My daughter's.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Living and I thought for sure that the police were going to be there waiting for me, but I'm not going to miss this. And I go to the hospital. I see my daughter reborn. And then, you know, my family's there, whatever. And I take off and I'm leaving.
I'm leaving the hospital, and there's a chapel. And I stop in the chapel, and I pray to God, and I ask, you know, hey, give me another chance.
Did you get, like, an intuition telling you to go in there?
I don't remember. I just remember I'm going there, and I prayed to God, like, hey, give me another chance. Give me a chance at life again, and I promise I won't get in trouble again. And if I do, give me a life sentence because I deserve it.
Wow.
And then, you know, I get 6 years for shooting two people?
Yeah.
That's crazy. And
that
then
is,
I get out.
That is fucking crazy.
That's crazy. And then
especially
I get,
then.
And know? Then I get out and I, you know, relapse, do the same old thing, and I get life.
Yeah. Just like you asked.
Just like I asked. Is it coincidence? No, it's God, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have told you it was a coincidence probably 5-10 years ago. But when so many coincidences happen like that, it makes you go, dude, what? Like, you know.
I could go on and on about stories like that.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you that, you know, we don't know a lot about what's going on. I know that, you know, Jesus is real.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in this world. I don't want to get all religious right now. But,
yeah.
Good is bad and evil is good right now.
Yeah.
And that's... It's talked about in the Bible. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. End times,
right? We just leave it at that.
Yeah.
You know?
So let's talk about some of the stuff that you saw in prison and go as deep as you want. I don't want to, you know, I know this stuff is, most people that I know that have been to prison have PTSD, like legit PTSD. So I don't want to overstep in that, but I know that there was an incident with a young kid that got stabbed. And do you want to talk about that?
Well, you know, essentially, you know, this kid, very young kid, came to prison for killing two people, drunk driving. I can't remember exactly. He was on drugs, got a life sentence, and they sent him to a yard. That was serious.
How old was he?
Probably 18, 19 Damn. Years old. They sent him to a serious yard. You know, prisons, you got all different kinds of yards. You got level 4 yards that aren't really serious. You know, I don't care what, you know, Wes Watson says and all these people say or whatever about anything.
Yeah.
You got yards that are serious, and you got yards that really aren't, you know, and... But this yard was serious. It was a 180 yard. And
what's a 180 yard?
It's essentially a yard where, you know, it's just dangerous. It's level 4, the highest security.
Yeah.
You know, it's a dangerous place.
Got it. Okay.
It's the worst yard you could be on in the state of California.
Okay.
And they're all pretty bad.
Got it.
You know, and this kid got coffee from a black guy. And one of the white boys seen it.
And you're not supposed to do business with
you're
other
not
races,
supposed to,
right?
You're not supposed to. On these yards, I mean, you could, you know, there's gonna again, what I say, there's something there, every yard's different. You're not supposed to do a lot of things on yards, but it happens.
Right.
I can get into that later. But, you know, he got coffee from a black guy. And these guys are against that, 100%. Not all of them, but, you know, people just have to go. When you're on a yard like that, you got to go along with it.
Right.
I wasn't going along with it. You know, I wasn't happy about it. And essentially what happened was when he came to yard, you know, they killed him. I remember seeing the knife. It was so big, you could see, you know, when they put it through him, you could see it, like, push his jacket out.
Mm.
You know, he's screaming for his mom. It was terrible, dude.
Yeah.
It was fucking terrible. And it happens all the time. It's just, you know, it's just, they just slaughter people. On these real serious yards, they just slaughter you.
How many murders did you see?
I don't know, maybe 6.
And then countless stabbings, right? Like a lot of stabbings where people don't
die. I'll give you an example about a J-Cat. This was back in the 90s. So there's this older guy. He's, I don't know, probably in his 60s. He's doing life, you know, and his cellie left, and he's essentially playing the lottery. What that means is you don't have a cellie, so you're playing the lottery. When somebody comes off the bus... When they, you know, are out of ed seg, they're putting that person in your cell. You don't really want to do that. Right. You always want to keep a cellie. You know what I mean? So it's, he didn't. And my cellie was a shot caller at the time. And he comes out to day room and he got a cellie off the bus. And he's like, hey, my cellie's a J-Cat. I got to get him out of there. It's crazy. You know, so all three of us went up to CO and just told the CO, hey, you know, we need to get this guy's cell move, you know? He's like, all right, after chow. You know? And before chow's count time, which is like 4 o'clock. So, you know, after chow, we'll take care of it. So I remember, you know, sitting in my cell. It's now it's count time, and I hear the cops yelling, "Hey, get down, get down, get down!" You know, they're at that cell.
Mm.
And that J-Cat, you know, beat the old man up, popped both of his eyes out with a spoon, you know, and stuffed them under the, you know, under the desk.
Did he kill him?
No, but he popped both of his eyes out with a spoon, you know?
Yeah.
Like, stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
You see crazy, crazy crap, but...
Stuff like that that you can't unsee, too.
It's just some things you don't forget. Just like in your childhood, you go through trauma and you just don't forget it.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain things that, you know, that are going to have an impact on your life.
Did prison make you hyper aware of your surroundings?
Like, oh, yeah.
Like do you, can you relax?
Yeah. But the streets will make you like that, too.
Yeah.
Running around like I was running around, I was always just looking. Well, anytime I go into a place, I look who's there.
Yeah.
Is this guy a threat? Is that guy a threat? You know, some people will tell me, hey, you're not institutionalized. Like, you don't act like you've even been, like, it doesn't seem like you spent all this time in prison.
Yeah.
Some people adapt well, but I definitely don't like walking down the street at night.
Yeah.
I definitely, every time I go somewhere, I'm looking at, you know, who's this? Is this guy a threat? Is that guy a threat? What's going on here? This ain't right. And I'm, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, some people, you could just see them, they're just lollygagging around.
Right.
They just don't have a care in the world.
Headphones in, not looking
yeah.
anywhere but their
or
phone.
Just whatever.
Yeah.
And I didn't sleep for a long time. Matter of fact, just until recently, I started sleeping a lot better.
Really?
Like the last couple months. Like, I've never snored in my whole life.
Yeah.
Like, never. I've been to prison, you know, I never snored. And now all of a sudden I'm snoring. Like, and I think it's just because I'm comfortable in my life now.
Right.
I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah.
It just, you know.
You're finding peace.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that's important is, from my perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you've forgiven yourself for not doing the things that you maybe should have done, and also forgiving your past and your family and everything that happened. Is that right?
I think the reason, there's a lot of things that, I don't know. I don't want to get too far into that. Sure. I've done some pretty bad shit.
Sure.
But, you know, Jesus Christ has forgiven me. And I think, you know, I got baptized, I don't know, about 6-7 months after I got out. You know, I think that that's helped a lot. I'm not a perfect Christian by far. But I think that...
Is there a perfect Christian?
I've known some ones that are pretty good, pretty...
But are they perfect?
Well, they're not perfect, but you could see it in their eyes.
Yeah.
How deeply connected they are with God.
Sure.
Have you seen that?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, yes. Right?
Yeah.
But
I've seen that from people that are also bad people in society. Like, I've seen that same look.
Yeah. I don't know if that's maybe the devil.
No, I'm just kidding. No. Like, I think that there are people that really, really, really want to do good, and they just can't.
I'd say this. I'm still Chris Curtis. I still have the mentality. I still think, like, I still have these crazy thoughts. You know, I'm still me.
Yeah.
But I have a heart now.
Yeah.
I have compassion. You know, I care about people. Again, if they don't care about me, then I go right back to that mentality where then, you know, fuck whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I just know that. For a long time when I got out, I didn't sleep. Maybe an hour of sleep a night sometimes.
Right.
Like, it was bad. And this was a while back ago. Maybe 8 months ago. I was kind of going through it pretty bad. I didn't really tell nobody, but I was. I just wasn't sleeping. You know, I had, like, bad things going through my head. Like, for one, it's like, how did I make it through all this alive and all these other guys are dead?
Survivor guilt.
You know, that's a big thing. You know, there's a lot of people that I know are gone.
Yeah.
And I hear about almost every week I find out somebody else is dead that I've known. You know, by the grace of God, obviously God's been watching over me this whole time. Since I was a kid, through everything that I've been through. You know?
Yeah.
And I heard a saying a long time ago in one of these groups where the best way to honor your victims is to live a good life that you took away from them.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's called living amends, kind of, in a way.
Sure.
But the best way to honor people that you've hurt in the past is to live a good life.
Yeah.
And help people. You know, I'm very busy. I'm an electrician. I work sometimes 7 days a week. And I try, you know, I'm trying more to get out there. I'm trying more to get my story out there to try to help, because it is powerful. And I'm not the only one that has a powerful story by far.
Right.
You know, everybody's got a story. You know, our stories from where we come from are very powerful. It can help a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's if you choose to speak about it or not. You know, I happen to not be ashamed of, I'm ashamed of it, but I'm not going to hide it.
Yeah. Well, it's who you are, man. You know? I mean, look, and people are going down the same path, and they need to hear this story, and they need to, like, dude, you're going to undo all the bad shit that you did. If you haven't already, like you're going to undo all the bad shit that you ever did. Maybe not undo it, but you're going to put so much good in the world by sharing your story and by stopping other people from going down that road. Cause think about it, right? If you can share one person from maybe you connect with some 13-year-old kid that was in the same spot as you, and you can get them to divert and go down a different path, and maybe they become a doctor or a lawyer or a cop or something. Imagine how many victims you just prevented from happening down the road.
I went to a school a while back ago and spoke to some kids at Eliseo Viejo High School in South County, Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like, I don't know, 16 kids. You know, a few Hispanics, some white kids. I don't think there was any, maybe one black kid, or, you know, but I thought that these kids were going to be laughing the whole time. They weren't going to take it serious, but they connected like really well with it.
Right.
Then they were listening, and they were really impacted by it. And I gave them each a book. Not all of them. I gave, you know, I only had so many books, but I gave the books out, you know. But I think that it does get through to these kids. You know, they do listen to the stories, you know. And that's another thing too that's crazy is that, you know, a lot of these people that have been through all this stuff, prison, drug addiction, you know, whatever.
Right.
These are the people that kids listen to. They're not going to listen to some psychologist that's never been nowhere, that's never done nothing.
Yeah.
You know, wearing a suit or whatever.
Yeah.
Somebody that's never been through, they're not going to relate.
Right.
These kids want to see the people that they've looked up to.
Yeah.
Which, you know, sadly is people like us. People that have really been through it. That's who they listen to. That's, you know, where they get saved. Through addiction.
Well, planting seeds too. And I'll push back a little bit, because I think sometimes those psychologists, even though they may not be listening, it still gets in, right? So I'll tell you, I got an underage drinking ticket when I was under 21. I think I was like 17 or 18, something like that. But they made me go to actually I got two of them in a certain time span. And in the state of Oregon, where I lived at the time, if you get too many tickets underage drinking, they actually take your license for 6 months if you're under 21, right? They're trying to prevent drinking, driving, whatever. And in order to get your license back, you have to go through like a drug program, right? Where you go, you show up at this treatment center and you show up for a class once a week, and it's like, I don't know, 2 months long or something like that. Anyways, this therapist, and keep in mind, he was a sober guy, right? And so he had been through some stuff. So he wasn't just some psychologist like with a suit. So he had that life experience. But to me, I was just like, I'm not like these guys, you know, which is the typical like alcoholic, addict, you know. I mean, there was one guy who had just gotten out of prison for selling heroin. There was another. I mean, I don't know. I was very similar to these guys, but I just thought I was just better than them for some reason. Right. I didn't see myself as an alcoholic. And anyways, this guy running the class said this thing, and he was like, listen, when you drink and you do drugs and whatever, it's really fun in the beginning and it's like no problems, but then it becomes less fun and a little problematic, but still fun. And then it gets more problematic and not as fun. And then all of a sudden you see that you tip over to the other side of the scale and it's not fun and it's all bad, but you're still doing it.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing that and being like, whatever, dude. But then I realized throughout my life as I drank more and the fun started to go away, and I started just like, why am I doing this? All the stuff that I kind of laughed off when I was younger, I came back and I recognized, oh shit, that guy was right. You know, now I'm a little bit older and I can see, you know, how foolish I was, and that it's so important to plant those seeds too, especially with young people, you know, even when it seems like they're not listening, because they might not be, but it gets in there.
Yeah.
You know,
it does.
So what's next for you? So you've been out of prison for 2 years, you wrote a book. What's next?
Just to start telling my story more. Try to help people. You know, I'm going to start school in a couple weeks, get my C10 license for electrical. You know, that's my goal this year. And just to keep, you know, telling my story.
Where can people buy your book?
Okay, so you could buy it on Amazon. You could actually go to my Instagram page, which is OCTheDarkSide8083, and you could click the link on that page to buy the book.
And all of these are going to be link in bio, so, or link in the description. So whether you're watching this on YouTube, you're listening to this somewhere, the link to his social media profiles and to his book will all be there. So,
and then you can go to Apple Books. You can get the audio book from there. It's on Barnes & Noble's. You get their website. There's a bunch of places.
Did you do the audio? Did you read
it? No, but it's on. I just found out recently that it was on Apple Books.
Oh, no way.
I didn't even know that. But I want to get it on audio. I just haven't done it for like Amazon and all that. But and then you could also go to my TikTok page, which is OCTheDarkSide8083, and the link's on there to buy it. Okay. You know, and a portion of the money is going to at-risk youth.
Nice.
I'm going to find a place for, you know, for sports where kids, underprivileged kids need sports.
Yeah.
I think it's very important to keep kids busy.
Yeah, especially sports because, you know, you... if you maintain some kind of physical activity after school, you know, I played football, baseball, wrestling, all sorts of stuff growing up. And you know, you need to keep that on.
Yeah.
You know,
you got to keep kids busy.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing is a lot of, you know, kids, they come from single parent families.
Yeah. It's a lot of that.
A big percentage of people in prison are from single parent families.
Yep.
They just don't have the time to spend with their kids.
Yep. Yep.
And if you want a, you know, a signed copy, you could email me at chriscurtis8083@gmail.com. And I'll send you an email, send you a signed copy. You know, you could pay me on Cash App or whatever. I'll mail it to you. But, you know, it's a great story.
It is a great story. And
it's exciting, too. So,
yeah.
And it goes all the way from, you know, when I was just a little kid to where everything was good. And it goes all the way to how I went to prison both times. And it takes you through everything. And then how I changed, how I got out. And, no, here I am.
Yeah, the reason why I invited you on the podcast is some, like, look, I don't want to glorify violence. I don't want to glorify prison. I don't want to do any of that. But sometimes you have to put something out there that gets people to look, and then you give them what they really need to hear, right?
Exactly. So
they come for the carnage, and they leave with like, oh, shit, maybe I shouldn't do that.
So when I told my story, and I had to say what I had to say to go through the story.
Yeah.
You know, essentially... You know, you have to talk about it in order for to tell the story.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a good book. And it will give people hope.
Yeah. You know? Good.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming on today. I appreciate it. Any last words? Maybe one last positive message?
You know, just don't give up, man. You know, your life, you know, everybody has problems. My problems ain't the same as yours. But they're not much different. They're still problems. Everybody has problems, you know. And just get a support network. Talk to somebody. There's help out there for everybody now. You can go anywhere and get help for drug addiction. For anything for that matter, you know. And it's not going to be easy. And it's going to be a long road. But if you want to have a good life, you know, you got to make your life good.
Yeah.
Because nobody's going to do it for you.
Yeah. Nobody's coming to save you, right?
Nobody's going to do it for you.
Yeah. Chris, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.